We begin this fourth session as on previous occasions, wherever we are, whether we're in a group or whether we're alone at home, by making that link at the level of the heart, seeing ourselves as linked together in a vast network of light. And after a few moments of silence, I shall repeat the words which we've used on previous occasions. Let us remind ourselves that every one of us, wherever we may be, whatever our conscious state at the moment, has a contribution to make in this linking at the level of the heart. If any one of us opts out, then the others are the poorer for what we do not give. Remember the golden threads which go from heart to heart. As we saw in the first session, contemplative meditation may be defined as a certain way of looking, that is, the taking of a particular perspective. A perspective, first of all, on ourselves. Now, how do we do that? And how, and this is equally important, do we not do it? Well, there are at once two pitfalls to be avoided, and let us look carefully at these. The first of these pitfalls is to confuse contemplative observation with introspection. To confuse contemplative observation with introspection. They are quite different. The one is to do with observation from a platform of detached non-reflective concentration. Detached, non-reflective concentration. Introspection is an emotional involvement with the object of observation, an involvement which precludes understanding. Now, some of you have heard me say on previous occasions, get emotionally involved with other people, but whatever you do, don't get emotionally involved with yourself. Well, you can work that one out to your satisfaction. The former creates space and promotes freedom of action and growth. The latter intensifies emotion, which contributes to the building up of anxiety. And it's very easy to observe when the second has taken the place of the first. There may well be a build-up of religiosity and great intensity of emotion, and frequently the accompanying soulful look in the eye. Now, this is clearly an indication of the wrong level of operation. The second pitfall is to confuse observation with mental analysis. An example of this is when there is an attempt to cope with what one observes by thinking it through with mathematical precision. Now, I will face this thing. I will look at this problem. I will think it through. I want to think my way through to a conclusion. And the conclusions are false. Because this approach does not take into account the emotional content of the object of observation. And here, of course, is paradox all along the way. In order to see, you step back. In order to see, you step back. Now, if thinking about all this worries you, then just let it go. For if it worries you, this should be an indication that this is not something which should be your concern at this point on your pilgrimage. So forget all about it. What you should perhaps do is to take a different perspective even now on what is being described. Don't try to remember what I'm saying and thinking, well, I do wish that could be repeated because it's important that I remember it. It probably is of no importance whatsoever. Take this new perspective, even as you listen. Do so with other than your outward ears. Hear the resonance within, or the lack of resonance within, and move forward with the knowledge that is unfolding from within you, not trying to cling to some precepts which are coming from without. Now, what is this process of moving towards the observer platform? What are the steps? Well, we have taken them several times already. During each session so far, we have systematically taken the necessary steps. It is the process of what we have called, borrowing the phrase from the Quakers, centering down. The steps we take from identification with the body, identification with the emotions, and identification with the intellect. If you like, and this is something of an oversimplification, we take three steps backward. A step backward from the body, and don't confuse this with psychic experience outside of the body. This has nothing whatever to do with that. A step backward from the body, a step backward from the emotions, and a step backward from the intellect. In so doing, we are moving into the point from which this kind of observation is possible. The place from where we look with detachment. Now, it is necessary to emphasize this word detachment. Approach this from another angle. We are creating a mirror which will reflect what we are trying to see. Emotions will cloud the mirror and make seeing impossible, like steam on a mirror in a bathroom. So, once again, what we are doing is observing in a non-reflective way without emotion. What then are we observing? The component parts of what constitute our whole makeup. So you see, the centering down process is in fact more than a process towards something else. It is in itself the practice of contemplative meditation. We're not simply taking steps in order that at the end of the process we may learn contemplative meditation. We are in fact doing this very thing as we take the steps. And let us be quite clear and honest, this is not an easy thing to do. For it is the straight through method to self-knowledge. And he who knows his self knows also his Lord. He who knows his self knows also his Lord. To this we shall come later. Yes, it is difficult, but we can all do it. It is a disciplined way of learning to know, and such learning, as we have observed already, comes only by doing. The rewards are very great, though remember they are not the kind of results you should expect to be able to tot up after each meditation. Did I do it properly this evening? Am I getting any benefit from it? Oh dear, I don't think I am. And there you are, back into the state of introspection. Now, all right, this happens to all of us, but the moment you observe that you are in a state of introspection, then you've taken a step forward again. So you see, we're never out of the condition where contemplative meditation is possible. In fact, what we are speaking of is not just exercises done during a session in a chapel. We're speaking of a whole philosophy of life, a way of living. At first, and perhaps for a very considerable time, we can do this only just a very little. But to do this a very little is to do a very big thing indeed. For be quite sure of this, very great changes will begin to take place in your understanding of very many things. Very great changes will take place in your understanding of very many things, from people right through to politics. For as we learn to observe with detachment, we make it possible for more and more truth to emerge. Now, we can ask ourselves the question, what is it that begins to emerge as we regularly take our stand on the observation platform? You've probably already got a little picture of yourself standing on a platform in a tree. Well, if it helps, use it. One very clear picture will most certainly begin to emerge as we move along the way. And that is this, that our makeup, and that is, I think, a very good description of the personality husk with which we are all encased, that our makeup is made of very many selves. We begin to become aware of very many selves. We see that there is not one undivided self, but many selves which vie with one another for precedence and supremacy. Selves which, as they become invested with emotional content, swell into powerful desires. These are the selves which envelop and stifle that very potential or Christ self which we have seen to be the hidden splendor within us all. Look at this a little more closely. There is the self which clamors for food, the self which demands this, that and the other, everything from sex to money and so on. There is the self which passionately desires this and the self which equally detests that. And all these selves are children and servants of the one in whose service they operate day and night, the ego or lower self in man. They are in fact the false selves, and they are servants of the ego or the lower self. This then is the area which we learn to observe and which we observe with detachment. Now, at first we shall not observe it with detachment. We shall rush in and identify with these particular selves, and we shall get swallowed up, and we shall for a moment become that self. Our consciousness becomes completely immersed in that self, and that is us as far as we see ourselves. And as we look at these powerful emotional aspects of our makeup, we must learn as we look and as we become conscious of looking to step back from them, putting into effect the law of dissociation. Then their power begins to decrease. The grip they have is lessened as they are relegated to a place of detachment, as they are observed to be aspects of the personality and not the essential self. So this may sound contradictory, sound against perhaps your religious training, but learn to see all these things without feeling the least bit guilty. Guilt or feelings of guilt will not help you in the move forward. These are the shackles which need to be removed. Guilt may come later, the right kind of guilt, but at this stage we have to break ourselves free from any concept, oh dear, I must feel guilty about this. They are then treated systematically as usurpers. Entrenched in the citadel, yes, but they begin, or we begin to see them as intruders who have no right of residence. If you like, they're squatters. Indeed, they can never penetrate into the still center within. They cannot ever penetrate into the heart of the citadel. These false selves are, as I have said, children of the ego, or the great pseudo-self, which, said Jesus, is the usurper of the true self. And this pseudo-self has a hallmark by which he may always be recognized. He takes many disguises, and we'll look at one of them in a moment, but there is a hallmark by which he may always be recognized. In medieval times, many stories were told describing how in the garb of a monk, the devil would appear to tempt and allure those seeking to follow the path of truth. His face would be well hidden by the monk's cowl, his body covered almost to the ground by the religious habit. I say almost, for as he turned to go, his true identity would be revealed by the small but unhidden detail of the cloven hoof. And the false self within us, for that is what the stories were all about, is always revealed by the one identifying factor, whatever the guise. The hallmark of the pseudo-self, the label of I want. The hallmark is I want. A want which, when unrecognized or consciously conceded, may in a multitude of ways become a ruthless demand, a demand even for love. I want to be loved. Which part of me is it that wants to be loved? And looking a little closer, which probably means standing back a little further, we may become aware of something which at first may be startling or even frightening. It is this: the pseudo or false self quite frequently assumes and delights to wear a religious or spiritual guise. Indeed, the false self may blossom and flourish on religious food and perfect what used to be called by the old evangelicals the language of Zion. He speaks the language, or she speaks the language, to a quite remarkable and dazzling degree. His clothes may be theologically impeccable, and his propagation of the truth zealous. And we are warned of this very possibility by Jesus himself, when he said, "There will be those who protest that they have done great works in my name, but of whom I shall say at the last, I never knew you." There was no connection at all between this and the Christ self. I never knew you. So, operating from the observer platform, we begin to see, through camouflage, the hidden is revealed and the submerged is brought to the surface. You may, if you are given to Victorian hymnody, wonder if these personality aspects, these selves, are not those very troops of Midian who, for generations, Anglican congregations have prowled and prowled around during Lent. I used to love to hear them prowling around. One could almost visualize them insinuating themselves over rows of Victorian pine pews. The hymn charges us, "Christian, dost thou see them on the holy ground?" and then tells us to up and smite them. And that really gets us going, doesn't it? Up with the ego, I'll deal with them. It is, I suggest, more realistic to take them by stealth, here a little, there a little, softly, softly, catchy monkey. Take the ground from under their feet while they're not looking. Take the ground from under their feet while they're not looking. However we see them, remember, remember, and again remember that it is from the position of unemotional regarding, unemotional regarding, that we learn to see. The alternative is to become overwhelmed, fearful, and anxious. And so very many Christians emerge at the end of Lent, overwhelmed, fearful, and anxious from 6 or 8 weeks of masochistic studies. Now hear the words of Jesus referring to this very situation. Whoever cares for his own safety is lost. But if a man will let himself be lost for my sake, he will find his true self. May we at this point be silent just for a few moments. And at this point, you may like to reflect, just quietly to think about what we have been pondering upon. In the last session, I spoke of the divine impulse which for 2,000 years has been evolving within the consciousness of man, and which in the lives of individuals has brought knowledge of the indwelling Christ. I want now to relate these two concepts, the Christ within and the true self. And remember, there can be no final definition here because we're dealing with mystery. The Christ within and the true self. For they direct us to the same reality. And this is all we need to know. They direct us to the same reality. And here may I say a word to any theologically minded people who are taking part in this course. There are two possible levels of operation in approaching spiritual realities. Whether this be in the scriptures or the creeds or in doctrinal formularies. The theological and the mystical. Or to put it in another way, and to use a medieval expression, the way of scholasticism or the way of experimental wisdom, the two ways, scholasticism, theological study, or the way of experimental wisdom. Ours, as is clear, is the second of these two approaches. The second does not conflict with the first, but it must be seen to be a quite different level of operation and understanding. It does not conflict with the first, but it must be seen to be a quite different level of understanding. Each has its proper place. And I want to apply this level of understanding to the concept of the I Am, or Yahweh, or Jehovah, as it's often translated. the mystery of divinity first revealed to Moses at the burning bush. You may at this point like to picture the burning bush and this encounter between Moses and God. And feel your way into it. Feel your way into it. Use your imagination if you wish, but find a resonance at this point. The theological approach to this is to see it as an objective classification of the name of the transcendent God, an objective classification of the name of the transcendent God. Now leave that alone, will you? Let us see it now as that and more. For here we see a recognition by Moses of that divinity which was to rise steadily within the consciousness of the people of God and to coalesce perfectly in Jesus of Nazareth, to rise steadily within the consciousness of the people of God and to coalesce uniquely in Jesus of Nazareth. And this coalescence made possible those sublime statements relating to the I am consciousness. I refer just to one or two of them. I am the way, the truth, and the life. I am the door. I am the light of the world. And it is into this consciousness, to share in this consciousness, that we have been called from the shrouding, the veiling, and the overwhelming of that multiplicity of eyes, we are drawn into union with the true self, the Christ self. Be still and know that I am God. We come now to our meditation, and once again, wherever you are, make quite sure that you are sitting in a comfortable but non-somnolent position. And as on previous occasions, if you're relaxed in an armchair, if you can, leave the armchair and find a straight back chair. If you're in bed, you may want to sit up with your back against the bedhead. But a movement of into a different position is a very good help in a change of mind and a movement forward of intention. Your feet, if it seems right to you, if it feels right, without shoes, flat on the floor. If you need to unbutton yourself at the waist, well, feel free to do that, so that you can forget your body. Forget your body. And let us observe our bodies. Many of them perhaps have aches and pains in various places. Possibly 8 out of 10 of us have tensions in the neck and pains in the neck and shoulders. It belongs to our lifestyle and our cherished anxieties. But look at your body. Observe it and reverence it. For it is a temple of Holy Spirit. So we begin to take the steps which lead us to the platform of self-observation. And we become aware of our breathing, and as we breathe out, so we release as far as we can the tensions within the muscles. So with the out-breath, we drop the shoulders, the arms, and unfold the hands. And we let the waist and tummy muscles go. And relax the thighs and the legs. Make sure you're not tensing them against the chair or the floor. And now, just a few out-breaths. Breathing out, as it were, through all the pores of the body. And as you do so, just observe your body. If you can, hold a picture of the whole body in your mind's eye. I have a body, but I am not my body. And be aware of the emotions that have been clinging to you, perhaps throughout the day, perhaps for much longer. Emotions that have somehow chased you into the room, or emotions that you feel are pressing in upon you concerning after this meditation. Just recognize them. If you like, say hello to them. However nasty you may have told yourself they are. Just see them and let them go. Anything that is pulling into the future, into the past, just recognize it. Quietly observe it. And breathe it away. It may spring back immediately, but do it again. Breathe it away. Don't tense up, just keep your body relaxed. I have emotions, but I am not my emotions. be aware of the thought processes which chatter through the brain. And as you observe them, as you see yourself caught up in them, let them go. Don't struggle, but just let them go and keep your attention focused on the body. So this is the one concept you're holding at the moment in your mind. I have an intellect, but I am not my intellect. And be aware now of the still center within the chest, the place of light, the place of the I am. And in the silence, keep your consciousness centered there in the light. And if and when it wanders, bring it quietly back. Now we allow the light within this place of knowing, this deep center, this true self, to shine forth. And as we breathe out, we breathe as though from that point of light within, radiating the light and the love. that as we give, so we receive, and we are surrounded and enveloped in the light and the love. So for the closing moments of our meditation, we hold ourselves at the center of the light. Focus our consciousness once more, the center within. And we bring our meditation to a close with the prayer we have used on two previous occasions. Last time I asked the group in the chapel here at Kent House to join in this prayer, this great invocation. And now we ask you, wherever you are, to join with us in this prayer. From the point of light within the mind of God, let light stream forth into the minds of men. Let light descend on earth. From the point of love within the heart of God, let love stream forth into the hearts of men. May Christ return to earth. From the center where the will of God is known, let purpose guide the little wills of men. The purpose which the Master knows and serves. From the center which we call the race of men, let the plan of love and light work out, and may it seal the door where evil dwells. Let light and love and power restore the plan on earth. Every journey, if it is not to become wearisome, should have provision made for rest and refreshment on the way. And this should not be confused with falling by the wayside or failing to keep up a correct pace. For there is no correct pace. The journey you are taking is unfolding from within. You are not going through a series of lessons which you are required to learn, nor are you given advice to memorize. You may or you may not find it helpful at the end of this course to have a transcript. But if you do, then read through the transcript fairly quickly and stop only at the points where you find yourself saying, "Yes, that is true," from within. Which takes us back to the thought of resting points. these are the refreshment places of inner knowledge. The refreshment places of inner knowledge. Where you have already heard yourself saying, yes, I know. And remember, if you really know, and are not simply trying to persuade yourself, you will not feel it necessary to impress this knowledge upon others. You will not feel it necessary to impress this knowledge upon others. True knowledge, that is, knowledge of the heart, is refreshment. And that refreshment will radiate life to others. It will also give impetus to you to continue the journey. And here are the questions for today. We'll pause a moment whilst you make sure you have your pen and notebook. Question one. Have you practiced any of the meditational exercises by yourself? Have you practiced any of the meditational exercises by yourself? Question two. If so, what difference, if any, have you been aware of between doing this alone and practicing the exercises in the group, or if you are following the course alone without the tape recorder? If so, what difference, if any, have you been aware of between doing this alone and practicing the exercises in the group, or without the tape recorder? And thirdly, what have you been aware of in the sense of being linked with others in this course? And this applies to individuals as well as groups. What have you been aware of in the sense of being linked with others in this course? And this applies to individuals alone in their homes as well as groups. And now we come to today's reading, which I'm calling Prods from God. And Elijah went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a broom tree. And he asked that he might die, saying, "It is enough now, O Lord, take away my life, for I am no better than my fathers." And he lay down and slept under a broom tree. And behold, an angel touched him and said to him, "Arise and eat." And he looked, and behold, there was at his head a cake baked on hot stones and a jar of water. And he ate and drank and lay down again. And the angel of the Lord came a second time and touched him and said, "Arise and eat,
else the journey will be too great for you. And he arose and ate and drank, and went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights to the Mount of God. And there he came to a cave and lodged there. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him, and he said to him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And he said, "I have been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the people of Israel have forsaken thy covenant, thrown down thy altars, and slain thy prophets with the sword, and I, even I only, am left, and they seek my life to take it away." And he said, "Go forth and stand upon the mount before the Lord." And behold, the Lord passed by, and a great and strong wind rent the mountains and broke in pieces the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire. But the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a still, small voice. And when Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. And behold, there came a voice to him and said, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And he said, "I have been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the people of Israel have forsaken thy covenant, thrown down thy altars, and slain thy prophets with the sword, and I, even I only, am left, and they seek my life to take it away." And the Lord said to him, "Go, return on your way." So he departed from there, and he found Elisha.